Welcome to Reality Check Live radio program, discussing topics that are close to the heart of conservative America. If you love your family, your country, and honor God, Reality Check is for you. Join Mike and Clary and their exciting guests right here on the Tantalk Radio Network and on nettalkworld.com, also on uswebtalkradio.com. Check out our website, realitychecklive.talkspot.com. And now, here's Mike and Clary.
Good morning. Welcome to Reality Check Live with Mike and Clary. What a beautiful morning, Clary. How are you today?
I'm doing really good.
And even though we just spilled coffee all over our studio table, which if I had it set up properly, wouldn't happen. But that's the understanding, loving wife that I have.
Okay. While I mop this all up.
Yeah. Hey, folks, I want to give you our phone number today. I'd love to hear from you. There's a lot of things that we could talk about. But today, we didn't really schedule a lot of guests. And so I'm going to give out the number, 866-826-1340. Once again, that's 866-826-1340. Love to hear from the folks in Arkansas area, and also Tampa Bay area. Lee, let us have the intro to our Superman.
Mr. Trouble never hangs around. When he hears this mighty sound,
here I come to save the day.
Mr. Wright is on his way.
That's enough, Keith. That's enough. That's enough. Lawrence, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Clary and Mike. The Arkansas area, the Tampa Bay area. And I would encourage you, now that I hear there's an opportunity here, for you people out there to put your coffee down, not like Mike did, but put your coffee down and call in and voice an opinion. As long as you're appropriate and pleasant, you'll be able to voice your opinion against or for whatever we talk about.
Well, I want to bring up a subject, and I know you would like to talk about this also. I want to talk about elitism. Now, often we think of elitism as people who are in the big oil companies like the CEO of BP and the one who was out there watching his yacht racing in England, had a jet back there. But we also have elitism in the White House, like Mr. Emmanuel, but also our president. Our president definitely has more than an elitist mindset. He's a narcissist, and most people will agree to that who study psychology, realize that value. But why is it's okay for those who are part of this, part of the food chain? They believe in evolution. They evolved higher than you or I could ever evolve into, but they believe in that mindset. I personally don't believe that. Why is it okay that they go golfing? Why is it okay that they could go to yacht? Well, one could go golfing and it's okay. The other one goes and watches this yacht race and he gets condemned. How does the rules for elitism pay off?
Well, you are exactly right. You see and hear examples of elitism from our president and his cabinet and people in government. All the time. What we have seen, and I have made mention of this for over a month now, that you have and are currently witnessing our president playing golf more with what he has on his plate than George Bush did in his whole 8 years. Now, how they rationalize that, I don't know. And now the media is out there demonizing the CEO of BP for going yacht racing and taking his corporate jet back and then to fly him back to Washington when you have Biden and Obama playing golf this weekend and Paul McCartney a couple weeks ago and all kinds of examples. And so I'm just saying they love to and feel that they are entitled to tell everyone else how to live and how to act. But when it comes to them, it doesn't apply. And if you don't get on the program and allow or enable that to happen, there's something wrong with you. It's not them, because they're in an entitled a part of society, and that's what I think elitism shows.
If you really need to know what elitism means to the liberals, right? It simply means we need to spend your money, and if it's not our money that we're golfing with, it is your money, it's okay for us. But for BP, if they spend their own money, then it's a crime. Because according to liberalism in this United States, we have such a poor government that we have to fork out every cent we can, pay taxes everywhere we can to keep them in office so they can have a roof over their heads and so they can go golfing and they can throw big parties at our expense. But if you earn the money, then you are, I don't know what they want to call you, but somebody who is not normal. So
well,
you see,
we're the little people, just like that one big guy from BP said. But that's how they all think, including Obama and Biden and Emmanuel and all of the others. They believe that they are entitled to rule over everyone else and how to spend their money that they haven't earned. And it's changing. And there is only one way the society, the American public in this case, have a way to change that. And unfortunately, this is the only way, but it's the best way that we have, and that is an election. And you're about to see it happen in November. You've already seen the trend changing. In November, there's going to be a huge shift change, and of course, Obama will not run again. But November, we are going to vote. And that is going to be the change that we had not hoped for, but is going to be the reality.
Okay, let me talk about another story that got some attention. ABC News, World News, Political Insights, Sticker Shock, jeopardizes President Obama's agenda. I'm also thinking that Obama's political insight or his programs or his sticker price is also going to be basically firing every one of those who have supported Obamacare and all the other, the stimulus, that I don't care if you're a Republican and you supported any of these things, you're going to be fired in November. And I don't think they realize what the sticker price of Obama and following his policies and giving him carte blanche with the $787 billion stimulus, which they only spent close to maybe $300 to $400 billion, and they want another $50 billion basically to bail out the states and the teacher unions, et cetera. And I'm thinking the American people, when they start realizing, hey, I work hard, the average guy makes about $45,000, and yet the state employees that are union are making an average of $75,000 to $80,000, do you think you're going to vote for people who give double the price for somebody who doesn't even work double the wage, or somebody doesn't even work as hard as the average Joe?
Well, Clary and Mike, you're going to see two things. One, if you're an incumbent, if you're in, you're out, especially if you have sided with the failed policies of the Obama administration. And number two, the stench of Obama and the Democrats will be another reason why you're out or you won't get in. And so there's going to be a huge sea change, and I'm hoping that a leader comes from that, and we see that leader leading us to the presidential election and out of this mess, because it is a big mess.
You know, the whole thing is, though, whoever is running for government, it's going to have to be probably whoever gets elected. It's going to have to be like, I believe that somebody has a calling from God to minister to God.
This is the station
people.
With Gary.
Yes.
Okay, well, I just got thrown off. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Anyway,
same here. But it has to be somebody that knows how to lead the country, manage the country, implement decisions for the best interest of its inhabitants and the country itself. We are so far from that ideal individual. I believe that we are heading to a huge change, and it can't come soon enough.
But do we see anybody on the horizons who can handle that position?
Well, I do have a presidential ticket right now that I believe that will. We're talking in June of 2010, which will probably change in 2011 or whatever as we get close to the presidential election. But today I see Mitt Romney as president and a man that has run corporations, knows how to manage, lead. And then I see General Petraeus as a vice president, a man that has a military experience. Success and a strategy of what's going on in the world. I see a team like that as opposed to what we currently have is now as a political a community organizer and a buffoon that is a gaffe a day. That is a large difference. But that's who I see that's going to lead us. And by the way, you people out there, Mike, give them the phone number again. Don't be afraid to voice your opinion of how right or wrong I or Mike and Clary might be. What do you think?
You know, the number is 866-826-1340 on this particular subject. But, you know, there's so many things going on right now, like in your neck of the woods in St. Petersburg. We have Charlie Crist, the governor of Florida, that there was a very important bill for a lot of us, and which is the majority of the population now who believe that abortion is wrong. There was an abortion bill there, basically, that we will not accept federal money for abortions. We will not give state money for abortions. And also that any woman who's going to have an abortion to see a sonogram, and Crist veto it. But right now in the polls, Crist is leading Rubio by a couple points right now, and it's so hard to say what's going on in Florida. Things are like kind of fickle right now, and I can only hope and pray that the American people will start doing the right thing in this country. Because go ahead.
Well, I am disagreeing with the polls. I believe that the liberal media, like the St. Petersburg Times and other major media, are not portraying an accurate situation between Crist and Rubio. Crist was a rhino in the beginning, a Republican in name only. And he was a flip-flopper. He is a career politician. He is whatever is best for Charlie Crist, not what is best for the individuals of his state or the country. And his changing of his positions are very telling, and I believe that the Florida voter will not put Charlie Crist in that position, mainly because they're tired of people like Charlie Crist.
But the fact is, it's the voters. It's our fault that we are in the mess we're in right now.
Right.
Because we voted people who we don't know what they stand for, or we didn't care what they stand for, and now they are telling us by their actions and their reactions that we are nobody, and they can do what they like, and they can rape us financially and emotionally in this country and laugh at us at the same time. But the people needs to get their act together and says we need to vote for things that are healthy for our nation. We need to vote for people who stand for Judeo-Christian values, who stands for what's right, and for who stands for what's good for our nation, not for who we like and who we don't like, or what people who we can sit down and have a cup of coffee with. Or we can buy them by our votes and things like that.
Or
we
maybe
need
a beer summit.
What, yeah, a beer summit. Well, it's never been more important to be an American citizen than to exercise your most important right to vote and be an informed vote. And if you don't cast your informed vote, you have nobody to blame, like Clary said, than yourself. And that's the most important thing that you can take from today's provocative pontification that I'm giving. But be informed and vote and encourage everyone else to. And if you my bias will be, if you don't know the right way to go, go right anyway.
Hey, with that, Mr. Wright, God bless you, sir.
And God bless America.
And folks, when we get back, we got a constitutional expert going to be talking about the health care bill and the challenges that are going to happen or take place in court. We'll be right back after the break.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you struggling with too much credit card debt, sky-high interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees, having trouble just making the monthly minimums? We can help. We're Credit Card Relief. We've helped thousands of people become debt-free in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars and without risking your family home. No, this isn't bankruptcy. It isn't one of those credit counseling deals or a high-interest consolidation loan. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're an attorney-driven program with an outstanding record of performance and client satisfaction. If you're serious about getting out of debt, call Credit Card Relief right now. Don't wait for the collection calls to start. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call Credit Card Relief now at 1-877-515-8148. That's 877-515-8148.
BMMI is a Sarasota-based masonry company providing complete structural concrete services and products and equipment rental for custom residential properties and waterfront homes. With 30 years of high-performance operations in the greater Manatee, Sarasota region, BMMI has achieved an outstanding reputation for thoroughness on the job and quality in the products and services that they provide. Covering a geographic area from Palmetto to Venice, including the Keys, BMMI is well known for tackling difficult residential layouts with consistently superior results. Call 941-377-5376 today to find out how BMMI can help you. That's 941-377-5376. 941-377-5376. BMMI, quality you can build on.
Tampa Bay's Tantalk. Entertaining and informative radio for the Sunshine State.
And welcome back to Reality Check Live. And on the line, we have Professor Jonathan Adler of Case Western Reserve Law. Professor, welcome to Reality Check Live.
Okay, hello? Lee's checking on something. He'll be right with us.
I'm here.
Welcome to Reality Check Live, Jonathan. Good to have
you. Thank you.
I was just looking you up on Wikipedia. Nice write-outs about yourself there. And could you give the listeners some of your background in law?
Sure. I teach constitutional and regulatory law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law, where I also direct the Center for Business Law and Regulation. I've been writing and teaching on constitutional law and related federalism-related issues for about 10 years.
You know, it's only the last 3.5 years that Clary and I even knew there was such a debate about the Constitution, because most of our life we've been part of what you call inner city ministries and different mission trips we've been on. And about 3.5 years ago, we started to look into the cultural issues, and we didn't realize that there are people who believe that our Constitution is bedrock, and then there's people who believe that it's evolving. And what a difference these two different beliefs make. And I think we're seeing it in the court system. And it could actually, one day, we might see a great divide in our nation over these two type of beliefs.
No, it's very true. There are two very different approaches to the Constitution that people advocate. And a lot of folks argue that the Constitution should simply evolve to meet modern preferences. And the problem with that is that the whole point of having a Constitution is to place some constraints on politicians and on the political branches, and to place some limits on what government is and is not allowed to do. That's the whole point of of having one. It's the whole point of writing it down. And it's an important part of our overall legal system.
And you're wondering what our children are being taught today in public schools. I'm wondering if they're being taught that this is bedrock, it's foundation, this is why America has made change. Or are they going with the theory, even our president, who claims to be a constitutional authority, believes that it's evolving, so therefore what our founding fathers believed in, we can't justify it any longer because we have changed?
Well, that's right. I mean, certainly the president has argued that he wants judges that will empathize and will use empathy to help decide decisions rather than simply looking at the meaning of the text of the Constitution.
And you're representing National Federation of Independent Businesses. Are they like the mom and pop type businesses or businesses under 50 employees?
Well, I'm on the advisory board of something called the Small Business Legal Center at the National Federation of Independent Business, and NFIB represents small business nationwide, a lot of their members are mom and pops. A lot of them are folks that maybe own a dry cleaner or a restaurant or a small print shop or a handful of small print shops, and they're very concerned that a very expansive view of the Constitution or a very flexible view of the Constitution could justify all sorts of intrusive measures that could affect their members.
Yes, and so you filed on behalf of them. Oh, Cleary, please. I'm sorry.
I opened my mouth to say something, and he jumped in. Okay.
She's whispering to me. I love you, honey. Oh, yes. Okay, go ahead.
My question is that what exactly are law students being taught out there that that when they are backing people like the Obama right now, President Obama, in their view that the Constitution is evolving? What kind of law are they being taught in the colleges and universities?
Well, I think a lot of people teach the view that the Constitution should evolve and that part of the role of judges is to make constitutional rulings based on their sense of how legal views and popular views have evolved or should evolve. So a lot of people are taught the idea that the Constitution should be what some call a living document, a document that changes over time. My view, and certainly the view of many others, is that the Constitution was written to endure, and it also includes a mechanism for modifying it or changing it if conditions require it. There is an amending process. We've used it to do lots of things over the course of American history, and that's the proper way of amending a constitution, and that it's not so proper to amend it simply because a majority of justices on the Supreme Court think we should do something differently.
You know, one of the reasons we brought you on, I have been very excited about having you on because you're a constitutional expert professor, and we have been covering the different lawsuits, the 20 lawsuits of the 20 states that are filing lawsuits against Obamacare. We actually heard the state attorney of Virginia speak one day when we were at Liberty University, and it was just outstanding what he had to say. We also interviewed, of course, Liberty Counsel, and there's been a number of organizations, plus medical organizations, that have filed for a lawsuit against Obamacare, and you're representing the National Federation of Independent Business in a lawsuit against Obamacare or the healthcare bill, healthcare law. And now I understand that the Obama administration is filing to have it thrown out of court. Would you explain to us what's going on?
Sure. The NFIB joined the lawsuit filed by 20 state attorneys general, arguing that key provisions of the health care reform bill are unconstitutional because they exceed the scope of the federal government's enumerated powers and intrude upon those areas that are properly left to state governments. And the key issue in the case, or in this litigation, is the nature of the federal government. When the Constitution was written, it included a list of limited and enumerated powers of the federal government. That is, the Constitution delegated to the federal government powers to do certain things, to raise armies, to establish laws governing immigration, to regulate commerce among the states, to to do other established uniform laws for bankruptcy, but various specific grants of power. And the key issue in this lawsuit is whether or not that list of powers is in fact a limit on what the federal government can do, or whether or not the federal government has the power to do pretty much anything that can pass Congress and get signed into law. And the part of the law that's really at issue is something called the individual mandate, which would require every American to purchase health care insurance as detailed by the federal government. And this would be the first time in American history that the federal government has sought to use its power to regulate commerce to force all American citizens to purchase a good or a service from private companies. And it's really a breathtaking assertion of federal power, and it's what's at the heart of this lawsuit.
Now, what is the grounds that the federal government is standing on?
Well, they argue that this action, this individual mandate, is necessary and proper to the regulation of commerce, and in particular, that it's necessary and proper to effectuate other parts of the health care reform bill that the federal government argues are clearly within its power to regulate commerce. And no one disputes that the federal government has broad authority over economic affairs and economic activities. The federal government can regulate health insurance companies. It can control what sorts of products they offer and how they offer them and how they market them and so on. The question is whether or not that authority, the authority to regulate commercial transactions, includes with it or brings with it the power to require individual Americans to purchase health insurance that they don't want. And the federal government says that's necessary because if it doesn't do that, it's hard to expand risk pools and keep health care costs down. The 20 state attorneys general that have filed suit and the NFIB are arguing that no, the federal government has the power to regulate commerce, but it doesn't have the power to force Americans who don't wish to be part of that commercial activity to enter into it, and that sort of mandate is not regulating commerce and is not consistent with the idea of limited and enumerated powers.
So it seems like the federal government is being used to join the dictatorship of this country by telling everyone what they need to do and how they need to do it. Not only telling us, forcing us to do what they or what the powers that sits in the White House wants us to do. Is that so?
Well, I mean, it is a dramatic reconception of the role of the federal government. In fact, I was at a conference this past weekend where a very prominent legal academic who has filed a brief in support of the federal government acknowledged that at the heart of this lawsuit is a changing conception of what it means to be an American citizen. One thing to think about is that prior to this health care bill, the only things the federal government has forced all Americans to do are things like pay taxes, register for the draft under the Selective Service Act, and things like that, things that are intimately tied into citizenship. The third thing the federal government can require individuals to do is to serve on a jury if they are qualified to do so. These are all things that we kind of understand as being tied into what it means to be a citizen, paying taxes and fulfilling certain responsibilities to the government. This would become only the fourth thing the federal government has ever sought or asserted it could require every American to do. And it really reflects a changed understanding of what it means to be an American citizen, and that being an American citizen does not merely require certain basic duties of citizenship towards one's government or towards the society at large, but also requires a participation in a broad health care scheme of this sort, not by paying taxes to support health care for the needy, but rather to directly participate in health insurance in this way. So it definitely does reflect a changed conception of what the fundamental obligations of citizenship are.
One of the things we understand taxes are for a number of reasons. One, for the armed forces, for our police, for firefighters, for roads, for schools, and these are all good things for America, for our well-being, for our safety, and overall, it's good. Now, why can't the federal government come in and say, listen, we take care of schools, we take care of roads, and we do this for the well-being of the American people. So this is really not a controlling or demanding that Americans have health insurance. This is just a new tax so that we can provide health care. Because there's almost a thin line there. I really don't understand it. I'm not an attorney, but I'm just trying to think how they're going to argue this case. Can't they argue that this is just another tax for the well-being of the American people?
Well, what's interesting is that the federal government, if Congress wanted to enact legislation to increase taxes on all Americans and then to use that money to subsidize health care for those who can't afford it or for those who are in need, there would be little constitutional dispute. Federal government does that. Medicare for the elderly, Medicaid for those who are in particular need, those are programs that the federal government created and uses its taxing power to tax Americans generally and then spends that money in a way to help those that need help providing for their own health care. But
yeah,
that's not what the federal government did here. What the federal government did here is not increase taxes on everybody and say, we're going to use this money to subsidize the purchase of health care. Rather, what the federal government is saying to each American, you individually must purchase health insurance from a private company or you individually will be subject to a penalty.
Right.
And that's different. It's an indirect way of achieving the same goal, and arguably it's one that is problematic because it's indirect, because it's not members of Congress saying, we're going to impose taxes and we're going to make the case for those taxes being used to fund certain valuable programs. Instead, it's we're going to just impose this burden directly on individual Americans.
Well, let me ask you a question. When's the last time in American history, and I know you study this type of subjects, anything to do with law, when has America been so divided where 20 states are actually filing lawsuits? There are more that would like to do it, but for whatever reason, they can't. There are nonprofits filing lawsuits. You're filing a lawsuit on behalf of the organization you represented. When's the last time America has been so divided?
Well, I can't think off the top of my head of a case that has resulted in this many states filing suit this quickly over something so high profile. But state governments certainly litigate against the federal government quite frequently. They often sue the federal government, arguing that the federal government isn't giving them enough money to run certain programs. We've seen states file suit against the federal government over its administration of various environmental programs and the like. I think what's different here is that you have a program that's so high profile that everyone is aware of, that a large percentage, if not a majority of Americans, have concerns about, if not opposed, and was enacted in such a unusual way, just squeaking through. Usually these sorts of large programs, certainly if one looks at the various programs that were adopted during the New Deal, if they get adopted, historically have been adopted by large legislative majorities. In that regard, this health care reform was an exception, and one of the reasons it's so controversial and one of the reasons so many states have filed suit before the law has even taken effect, that is to say, before these provisions are actually being applied, is because it is so opposed by so many people, and that certainly does make it unusual.
You know, I believe that the general population just feels that this is an infringement on our freedom, and this is forcing us to do something that we should make our own decisions about, and it is a out of control feeling where it's like the government, you telling us what to do, and we're no longer the people of the United States of America. We're just puppets on a string that the government is pulling our strings, and it's a very, very uncomfortable position to be in, and that's to me, that's what the general population is feeling.
Well, I mean, it certainly is very unusual to see legislation that was so unpopular, and the polls were certainly showing it was very unpopular when it was enacted, nonetheless get pushed through, and get pushed through with some fairly unprecedented legislative maneuvering, which Congress had to do to secure the votes for passage. And, Yeah, I think that's why you see a lot of members of Congress now talking about whether it's possible to repeal certain portions of the bill, and again, why you see attorneys general from so many states filing suit against it before it's even been put into operation. And I think that that is a symbol of how controversial this legislation is. And I think that that itself should be a concern, because you have something that's very controversial, opposed by lots of people, and is arguably the most expansive assertion of federal authority we've seen in our nation's history.
Now, you represent, of course, the National Federation of Independent Businesses. If they see this law, if this law is not changed, what do they anticipate in the future, and will they be able to stay in business with this outrageous tax that's going to hit them?
Well, I mean, certainly many members of NFIB, many small businesses generally, will face new burdens, both tax-related burdens and regulatory burdens, from this health care bill. People that supported the legislation point out that it includes some tax credits for some small businesses to expand health insurance to their employees, but those tax credits expire after several years, but the burdens of providing the health mandates will persist. And so, I mean, one of the reasons NFIB joined this lawsuit is because it believes its members are going to be heavily burdened by this legislation, and in fact, because a majority of its members are very concerned that this legislation will dramatically increase their costs and make it harder for them to stay in business.
I believe that a lot of people feel that this, this, especially those who would like to start a small business or to excel in this is a land of the free, where you're supposed to be able to come and make a good living. And it seems like this law, this bill, is cutting the legs from under the people who would like to form a business and excel in it. And it's almost like killing the initiative of the people.
Well, certainly that's the concern. And I think the folks at NFIB believe, and certainly many other people believe, that it's not necessary to do that, either to control costs in the healthcare sector or to increase the number of people that are covered with health insurance, that there are other ways of achieving those goals that don't require imposing dramatic new burdens on small business, and that do not require such broad assertions of federal regulatory authority as we see in this legislation.
You know, we all, I don't know how you felt during the election, but when Obama won the election, we all felt that the one thing I really sensed that he was going to try to shred our Constitution, and I have to be honest, he didn't disappoint me. He's actually doing everything he can to do that. Jonathan, I know you got a couple of minutes, but I don't know if you're comfortable of changing gears, and maybe you give us a little insight to what's happening in Arizona with Arizona law and the federal law, and now I understand the federal government is going to be suing Arizona, and Nebraska wants to follow the same law. Can you talk about that at all?
A little bit. I mean, the federal government, or there are news reports saying that the federal government is going to sue to prevent Arizona from enforcing its recent immigration law. Arizona claims that the reason they adopted that law is because the federal government has not been enforcing federal law and has not been securing the border, and that Arizona has decided that it was going to take matters into its own hands, not by imposing or adopting lots of new requirements, but primarily by adopting a law that would require state and local officials within the state to enforce federal immigration requirements. And the key legal issue in the case is going to be whether or not it's going to be two issues. One is whether or not states have any authority to deal with immigration. And then, secondly, if they do, whether or not the existence of federal immigration laws preempts or displaces state laws like the one in Arizona. And it's going to be an interesting lawsuit because we've seen several other states talk about adopting similar proposals. The sorts of provisions that are in Arizona's law appear to be fairly popular, and are also a response to a widespread belief by people in border states that the federal government has not been particularly diligent in securing the border, and that's raised concerns in those parts of the country that have to deal with the consequences of having an insecure border.
It sounds like the federal government thinks they are above the law. They make the laws, but they don't enforce them, and nobody can say anything about it. And if they want to fall short on their part of what needs to be done to enforce the law, it doesn't really matter. It seems like they're already decided that they are in control, and you know they're going to do what they want, when they want, and how they want it. And I guess it's a trend of most of our government officials right now, and that they're, as long as they're okay, it doesn't matter what happens to the rest of the nation. But to actually sue the states for enforcing the law, it sounds kind of wrong to me.
Well, it will be a very controversial case when filed, and you know, the federal government hasn't filed the briefs yet, so you know we can only speculate on what arguments they're going to make, and you know it may be that they've come up with a very strong legal argument, but you know the federal government, like any government, has to make set priorities about where they're going to focus their enforcement efforts, you know, where the FBI or the immigration authorities or other federal agencies are going to devote their resources. But it does seem odd, as you note, that if the federal government decides that immigration or the border control is not a particularly high priority, it seems odd the federal government would complain or object when state governments decide that they're going to try and fill that gap. Normally, we celebrate when state governments take initiative to address problems that the federal government is either unable or unwilling to address. But here, the federal government is objecting, even more arguing that it is either illegal or unconstitutional for Arizona to do the things it wants to do.
Jonathan, I have one more question for you. Then please let us have your information, if you have a website or how we can read up more on this. Because the American people are holding their breath. They're hoping, overwhelmingly, they're hoping that this will be knocked out altogether. There will be no national health care. But the one thing I don't understand, there's a federal, say they have the hate crimes law in our land. Now, if I commit a hate crime to my neighbor who might be of different color, or my wife who's a different race than I am, now the local people could arrest me on that and charge me with a hate crime. Is that correct?
It depends on the state. I mean, some jurisdictions there is hate crime legislation. Some there isn't. My own view has always been that you know if you attack somebody or if you kill somebody, it's hard for me to think of you know how you know, you've killed them. And whatever your motivation was, it's murder, and we should prosecute that as murder. So I've never understood the trying to subdivide crimes based on the motivation, but it depends on the jurisdiction. In some jurisdictions, there's health crime. Hate crimes are themselves separate offenses. In some jurisdictions, they're not.
So basically, if Arizona is just trying to uphold the federal law, because I understand their law is no different than the federal law, we all don't understand why this is a big issue. If the federal government was doing what the law says they were doing, there wouldn't be a need in Arizona to have that law. Is that right?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, the biggest legal argument against the Arizona law is that it's preempted by the existence of federal law. The primary objection to the Arizona law is the argument that it will result in racial profiling. That is that the law will require state police in Arizona to stop and detain people based on their appearance or based on whether or not they, what race they are, or what ethnic background they are.
Right.
And that's certainly, I think, a reasonable concern.
Yes.
But the real question, and to me, is how Arizona will implement that law. That is how, you know, and how they how Arizona State Police will be trained to enforce the immigration requirements. And then more broadly, as you note, to what extent is Arizona really doing anything more than trying to enforce the federal laws that are already on the books?
Listen, I got to let you go. Police. Thank you so much for staying on as long as you have. Tell us how we could get in contact with you and read up more about these stories.
Well, sure. On the healthcare lawsuit, there's a website, www.healthcarelawsuit.us, and that has lots of information and materials about the lawsuit against the healthcare bill. Again, it's www.healthcarelawsuit.us, and there's lots of information there about this litigation, about the issues involved, and events as they happen in the litigation.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Jonathan. God bless you, sir.
Thank you.
Folks, we'll be right back with Insights to Dr. Ma.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
ACLU demands apology for prayer at commencement. I'm Garrett Messmacher, and that's coming up next. Following the spring 2010 commencement ceremony at Montana State University, the ACLU of Montana Foundation wrote a letter to the legal counsel of Montana State University. It demanded an apology for an invocation and benediction that mentioned Jesus Christ at the recent graduation ceremony, which was given by Pastor Tim Zerger, a member of the Harve Ministerial Association. The ACLU sought the apology after allegations that university faculty had complained. The ACLU claims that the invocation was a direct violation of the Constitution because it required faculty members to, quote, attend a government-sponsored religious service. However, if the school were to have directly censored the prayer, then they would have been preventing the free exercise of religion, and such would be counter-constitutional. The ACLU mentions a few cases where similar invocations were deemed unconstitutional for primary and secondary education. However, it is important to note that when within a university, similar cases that have supported specific prayers. The ACLU is tricky and constantly needs to be exposed as they try to take away our religious freedoms.
Liberty Council is a religious civil liberties education and legal defense organization. For more information, call 1-800-671-1776.
Tampa Bay's TAN Talk. Entertaining and informative radio for the Sunshine State.
And now it's time for Insights with Dr. Mom, dealing with family issues of the day and discussing a common sense way to solve the problems we're all faced with our families today. That's Insights with Dr. Mom, heard right here on TAN Talk Radio on Reality Check. And now, Dr. Mom.
In trying to prove that there is no God, a professor taunted his students by asking if any of them were Christians. As none of the students reacted, he chose one student and mockingly asked, "Are you a Christian? Aren't you, son? The boy replied, "Absolutely." To which the professor continued, "So you believe in God? Is God good? Is God all-powerful? Can God do anything?" "Yes," the boy replied. The interrogation continued as the professor asked, "Are you good or evil?" The student replied, "The Bible says I'm evil." The professor grins as he says, "Aha, the Bible. Let's say there is a sick person here. Would you cure him? Would you try to help him?" "Yes," the student replies. To which the professor continues, "But God does not. I had a brother who died of cancer, and God did not heal him. So how can you say that God is good? Does evil exist?" "Yes," the student replies. The professor then said, "Since God created everything and evil exists according to the principles that our works define who we are, then God is evil. Do you believe in Jesus Christ?" "Science says you have 5 senses. You use them to identify and observe the world around you. Have you ever seen, tasted, smelt, or have any sensory perception of Jesus Christ or God?" A little baffled, the student said, "No, sir, I haven't. I only have my faith." The professor said, "According to the rules of testable, demonstrable protocol, science says that God does not exist. Then the student asks, "Professor, is there such a thing as heat and cold?" "Definitely," the professor replied. "No, sir," the student replied, explains. "There is heat, but not cold. You can have lots of heat, even more heat, superheat, mega heat, unlimited heat, little heat, or no heat. But there is no such thing as cold. Every body or object is susceptible to study when it has or transmits energy, and heat is what makes that body transmit that energy. Absolute zero, or minus 458 degrees Fahrenheit, is the total absence of heat. Therefore, the word cold describes the absence of heat. Cold is not the opposite of heat, but the absence of it. The student asked the class, "Has anyone seen, touched, heard, or felt the professor's brain?" Everyone shook their heads, "No." So according to the established rules of stable, demonstrable protocol, science says that you have no brains, with all respect, sir. So by faith, we have to believe that you have a brain, and by faith, we accept that God exists. This is Insights with Dr. Mom. Faith in God brings blessings. Trust him. You will be glad you did.
You know, Claire, you went through a very sad situation a number of years ago. Your brother, who was a Baptist pastor, he had a brain tumor, and I believe he lived for about 4 years afterwards, and he passed on. Mm-hmm. And through the whole thing, it's very difficult to see something like that, but you can see how God's hands was in his life, because he didn't have a whole lot of things going for him after the tumor was taken out the second time when it came back, but he was still able to function, and he was at peace with his life. And he did a lot of good, even in the nursing homes, by encouraging other people there, ministering to them. And so not every situation, you know, even a bad situation, God could still be seen in it and still be seen as good.
Well, I don't believe that God killed him or God turned his back on him. I certainly believe that my brother fulfilled God's plan and purpose in his life. There's, you know, there's a saying that says there's only two things that is really true, and that's taxes and death.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact is, we're all
guaranteed. Only two things guaranteed.
Yes, we're all going to die one day, whether we die young or we die old. As long as we have fulfilled God's plan and His purpose in our lives, then it's fine for us, except obviously those who blow themselves up. I don't believe it's God's will that they blow themselves up, and I believe that they're looking for something and their own screwed up thoughts that make them blow themselves up. But we live and we touch lives along the way. We encourage others, or we make decisions that will help others or even help ourselves. And those things are the blessings that God has given to us.
And, folks, I don't believe it's God's will that those that get blown up by these people either, but God still knows how to turn an ugly thing around. Thanks for listening to Reality Check Live. Clary and I will be back tomorrow. God bless you and...
God bless America.
You just called out my name.
You've been listening to Reality Check right here in your TAN Talk Radio Network stations and Net Talk World Global Talk Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. To hear more, go to our website, realitychecklive.talkspot.com. We thank all those who listen today and want our troops to know serving in harm's way that we love you and support you. God bless America and all those who defend, protect, and serve her. We'll be right back.